Be seated. It's good to be back. I'm glad to be with you again. I miss you when I'm gone. I had some national church responsibilities in our church family, so I was gone last weekend. It was only a weekend, but I always like being back here. Church is always better here. Okay, so just saying. I'm not comparing. I'm just saying. If you're a guest with us and you're new with us, we're so glad that you're here. Someday I hope to miss you too, because I'm glad that you're here, and you're hope that this you find that we're just a bunch of people who are trying to who are just trying to help each other meet, know, follow Jesus, and we want to do whatever it takes to help people do that. So that's what we do. The question today that we're trying to get to is something that relates to everybody, even people who aren't sure what the Bible means and how it all it goes and what Christianity is about and what about Jesus. And everybody, even if you've known that and you've known the Lord for like 30 years, this relates to everybody, because here's the question. The question is, what is it about the character of God that he keeps using this character quality, that he keeps expressing this, and it comes up again and again and again throughout history, throughout Bible history, throughout the entire Bible and world history, right up to this moment and right now in this world and in this place? Is there, in other words, to put it this way, is there one unifying theme, is there one unifying deal that God is up to in the Bible and up to in our lives, and that just binds it all together? And the answer is yes, there is. But to get at it, I want to just quickly review where we've been as we've begun to read through the Bible and this Love This Book reading plan that we've been doing. And we're you know, in the first five books of the Bible. And what we've recently been looking at is the end of Genesis, where you got all the laws and the rules, you know, the Ten Commandments, and then do it this way, do it this way, which I said 2 weeks ago was the Ten Commandments are the basis of all those other laws. They're just explaining how to live those out, right? But still, you look at all these laws, and then you come to Leviticus, which we're coming to this week, and it's like, whoa, you know, you got all these laws and rules, and it's kind of weird to read those in the culture and the world we live in today, isn't it? Because we live in an authority adverse society. We live in some cases among people who are allergic to authority. Like, just ask one of your police officer friends when they show up, if people don't oftentimes act allergic, right? Because they're carrying the law with them. They're carrying the authority with them, right? And through our minds, and we'll talk about why this is a little later, but through our minds, it's like, oh, when there's a law, that must mean I'm in trouble, you know? That's not what the laws of the Bible are meant to express, but that's kind of how we play it out. And the problem is we live in a world now who has sort of reversed the values, reversed the price tags, has sort of made something that was good bad, okay? Because we have this thing that is called personal autonomy and choice. Whatever I want to do with my life, I should be able to do with it regardless of what other people think about it, regardless of what, you know, if it hurts somebody else's autonomy and so forth, right? In fact, it's almost become a morality to the point, and it's taught in schools and many people right on down to, you know, preachers and pastors and the local, right on down to, we just kind of tend to think now that if someone is, you know, crimping somebody's style or taking away some authority or something, that's bad, right? That's bad. And in that context, how can a God who gives laws be good? I mean, that question is starting to be asked today. And so what we need to say right off the beginning is that when God gives these laws, when God gives these things, they're not just edicts to control us. He's trying to give us something good. And to get an understanding, let's go back to the very beginning of our reading through the Bible. Genesis, the first three chapters. Remember the fall in Genesis chapter 3? You can go out back and check this out. When Adam and Eve fell and sin entered the world, sin entered them. And sin entered the world, and God did something. He knew this ahead of time, but he did something he didn't want to ever have to do. He cursed them. He expressed a curse. I mean, he didn't technically curse them. He was actually just expressing what had happened now that sin had entered the world, what was actually true about Adam and Eve, certainly about the serpent. But right in the middle of this, you can look this up, in Genesis 3:15, God says, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to send somebody to fix this thing that has gotten between you and me called sin, because God can't have sin in his presence, and now you've got to let it in. I wish you hadn't. You're under the curse. I'm going to fix it. In fact, I'm going to fix it so much that by the end of biblical history, by the time you get to the end of Revelation, yeah, we're back in Eden, but it's a way better Eden, right? But right there in the beginning, God launches into something that I don't want to be sacrilegious or crass, but what God launches into is a passion, or I would say, this is a word we usually use negatively, but I'm using it positively. God has an obsession to redeem his people, redeem the world. God has this, he's got this redemptive obsession, not just to redeem the planet and the plants, although that's all in there, but to really, the real apple of his eye, the real thing he's going for is to redeem his favorite part of creation, which is human beings, you and me. And you see this obsession play out over and over, and that's why all those laws are there. That's the case we're going to make today. Because we're going to look at some stuff that we usually don't think of as really, you know, changing our life very much in the Old Testament. But if you look at it through angle of what God is doing, it really does. And how it fits with the New Testament, it really does start to impact you. Because God has this obsession to redeem his fallen world that has fallen, this horrible thing called evil and sin. And you can see how this sort of plays out. Let's just take the idea that we said on every book of the Pentateuch. By the way, the Pentateuch is the first five books, right? This is how you can remember. This is important. Because the Pentateuch lays the groundwork of everything that's going to happen through the rest of the Bible. Pentateuch, you can remember Pentateuch this way. Penta is five, like the Pentagon, right? And toque is what you'd be wearing when you wear a stocking hat if you lived in Canada. See? Yeah? You're going to remember that now. So there you go. So just walk through the Bible right there. But the Pentateuch, in each book, sort of has this hinge chapter. Where, you know, the first part of the book will say something and then they'll have this chapter in the middle and then the rest of the chapter will kind of play that out in a practical way or something else. Like Genesis, we saw that it was the first 11 chapters were about God's creation of the world and how sin entered the world and what happened and the flood and all that kind of stuff. And then in chapter 12, God gives a promise to Abraham that it's the redemption obsession. I'm going to fix this. I'm going to bless the world through your family. And the rest is about his family. Exodus. The first 18 chapters are about the Exodus and how they got out in the wilderness in the first place. Then they come to a place called Mount Sinai in chapter 19, which is the hinge passage. And from then on, it's the Ten Commandments and how you shall live with me, because I don't know if you knew this, God is basically saying, but you have a God, and his voice sounds like this, boom, from the mountain, right? And so, again, it's all about God's obsession to redeem people and redeem his people, and he's telling them how that's going to work. Last week you looked at Numbers, where God really wanted to take it to the next level. He offered them an entry into the promised land in chapter 13 and 14 in the book of Numbers. We kind of skipped a book. We're going to get back to Leviticus today. But God offered them this chance to, you know, take the whole redemption thing to enter the promised land. They send the spies in. And they go, oh, no, there's giants in there. And we think you can probably handle God, but we're not sure. We don't know if we can trust you. And we know we can't handle it, so please, just send us back to Egypt, right? And so the results, the rest of Numbers is about the results of wandering around in the desert for 40 years because they had this chance at it and they didn't take it. Well, God's not satisfied with taking no for an answer when it comes to his redemption obsession. And I know today we're going to look at the book of Leviticus, as I said. You can turn to chapter 16. I know that sounds weird. No one had ever told you to turn to the book of Leviticus before. I know somebody's thinking, oh, honey, we should have gone with all those people on spring break. This is not the day to be at Eastridge. And you're saying, she says, well, we don't have any kids. Yeah, I know, but this is Leviticus? And I've made jokes about Leviticus. I mean, you know, what's the cure for insomnia? Leviticus. I mean, but I'm telling you what, there's something in the midst of chapter 16, which is that hinge pastor, passage that will just, if we can get our understanding around it, we'll take our understanding of the Bible, we'll take our understanding of what God's up to in the world, we'll take our understanding of what God is doing to every single one of us in our very lives to a different level. So It's just fascinating to see how the Bible, the whole story holds together over, you know, 66 books and 40 different authors and, I mean, you know, four continents and several millennia. I mean, it's just wild. It's just amazing of how this weaves together, and you start to realize this isn't just a book of randomness. There's a theme to it. There's a purpose. So let's start in verse 20 of Leviticus 16, and God is telling Aaron, the priest, what he's supposed to do and how he's supposed to do something in terms of dealing with the sin problem in Israel, among his people. It says, verse 20, when Aaron has finished making atonement for the most holy place, that is atonement over the Holy of Holies inside that tent, that tabernacle, that place of meeting, the tent of meeting and the altar, he shall bring forward the live goat. He is to lay both hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the wickedness and rebellion for the Israelites, all their sins, and put them on the goat's head. And he shall send the goat away into the wilderness in the care of someone appointed for the task. The goat will carry on itself all their sins to a remote place, and the man shall release it in the wilderness. And you're going, Dwayne, is this a joke? Like, really? I mean, a goat? Like isn't calling somebody a goat herder in the Middle East like a racial slur? And I would say, yes, it is. And we have a chance. There may be another chance. I don't have the details yet, so I'm not announcing anything. But 2019, to go to Israel again in May or June. Okay, so if you go, don't call him a goat herder. But what's that got to do? Well, you got to dig into what this really means and what the point is. A few verses later, it explains it to us. It uses a word that I bet you've heard and I bet you've used. It calls this goat the scapegoat. Waka waka. Maybe you've been a scapegoat. I remember the first time I heard the word scapegoat. I was in second grade. And there was this girl in my class named Margaret Brown. And I can remember, to show you how traumatized I was by this, I can still remember what she looks like. Or looked like then, not now. But she was pretty, but no girls were pretty to me at that point. And so she had this idea that she was going to chase me around. This went on for like a month. She'd chase me around at recess, and her friends were going to grab me, and she was going to hold me down, and she was going to kiss me. It was traumatizing. It was terrible. And then, for some reason, Mrs. Gray, our second grade teacher, decided to rearrange our seats, and she put me right behind Margaret. And the first day that happened, Margaret turns around in the middle of class and goes, I'm going to kiss you at recess. I couldn't handle it anymore. I said, shut up! And then I realized, oh, no. Mrs. Gray looked at me. I said, okay, Dwayne, in the corner. How long? For 30 minutes. I mean, that's where drug dealers and rotten people, they had, you know, if you were a mildly bad person, sinner, you could go for 5, but if you were really bad, shut up, we got you 30 minutes. And I knew, the worst part of it was I had to go home and tell my mom, and I said, Mom, first thing, I had to go in the corner for 30 minutes. She said, oh, really, what happened? I said, well, Margaret Brown was going to kiss me, and I told her to shut up. Well, honey, it's not good to say shut up, but I'm glad you didn't let her kiss me. I kiss you. And I go, ha, ha, ha. And then she said, you must have been the scapegoat. I said, yeah, I'm a scapegoat. That's the first time I heard of that. I mean, because it's not good being a scapegoat, obviously, because you get stuck out in the wilderness. But what God is saying is look, symbolically, this goat doesn't save anybody, but I'm going to redeem this place. I'm going to bring salvation to your life. I mean, imagine being an Israelite. You've seen Moses go up the mountain, Mount Sinai, Exodus 19, and heard the booming voice and seen the fire, and it's like, ah! And you've seen the priest go into the Holy of Holies once a year, that inner sanctum of the tabernacle, right? That tent that was their worship space. And it was like, wow, God's presence is there because I can see it in the cloud that descended, the Shekinah glory that descended on the tent. And you're like, wow, that would be cool to be that priest, but I don't know if I'd want to do it, man. That'd be scary. But if you live to tell about it, it would be pretty cool. And then you've heard stories about how in Eden, people didn't have this problem. People could walk with God in the garden and they wouldn't be destroyed. And this thing called sin entered the world and caused all these problems that that people experience today. And you realize that sin's not just some intellectual concept. I've got sin. And that's where the fear of God in the sense of, you know, repulsive fear, not reverence fear, but just the repulse, like, oh, I'm in over my depth, the possibility that God would be in my presence, that I would be in his presence. It's because of the sin. It's what Genesis calls the enmity between us. And that enmity between us and God, but also the relationship between each other. That's the thing that messes everything up. That's the thing that drives all of these problems. And what God is saying in this goat business, which winds up, as we'll see in a minute, being the Day of Atonement, is that Israelites could go, okay, there's a way to deal with this thing, the sin problem. There's a way to deal with the struggle that I have. And God is basically saying, I will be your scapegoat. If you trust me, see, God's asking them to do the same thing he asks us to do, trust him to take care of our sin. Now, in our case, this is 1,400 years or so before Jesus and the cross and Messiah and Easter. By the way, Easter's in 2 weeks. And it's before that. But God is saying, trust me, I'll take care of it. You send it out in the wilderness with this goat, I'll take care of it. He doesn't tell him how, but he's going to obviously ultimately do it through Jesus, 1,400 years or so later. But these people right here at this moment are wondering, you know, wow, God, you're going to do that? You must be serious about this. And God would say, yes, I'm obsessed with getting rid of that sin so that we can be in one another's presence again and so that I can love you the way I want to love you. In fact, look what it says. Skip down to verse 19. It explains this in a little more detail. This is a lasting ordinance for you. On the 10th day of the 7th month, you must deny yourselves and not do any work. We've heard about that, like in the Sabbath thing, which it'll mention in a minute. Whether native-born or foreigner residing among you. Because on this day, atonement, this is the Day of Atonement, will be made for you to cleanse you. Then before the Lord, you will be clean from all your sins. This is a day of Sabbath rest, and you must deny yourself to yourselves. It is a lasting ordinance. Not the day necessarily, but the fact that atonement is something that is a lasting ordinance, that everybody needs some atonement. Everybody needs some completeness. In fact, look at the word atonement and look what it means. It means to be clean from your sins before the Lord. That's exactly what we're told in the New Testament happens when we put our faith in Jesus, right? Because he hung on the cross and then he beat back the power of sin and death by rising from the dead. That's why Easter is worth celebration, right? Because here's the reality. You and I have all felt this problem that God is so obsessed with nuking, right? And we've all felt it. There's this nag that pops up every once in a while. That we feel it when we go, you know, I wonder if my friend still likes me because I was kind of over the top in the way I kind of put him down. Or, I wonder if my kids are the way they are because of my habits. Because of the way I disciplined them or didn't discipline them, you know, or, I wonder, why is it that I always fall into that urge, which is really a temptation? Why is it I always go back to that awful thing that I know is destructive to me physically or destructive to me relationally? Why is it that I always fall into that? Or even something as simple as this, why is it that I have such a hard time sensing God's presence with me? Because the Bible's clear. God is present with us all the time. Right? I mean, Acts 17, Paul says, it's in God that we live and move and have our being. He's actually borrowing a poet, a Greek poet's phraseology there, but he says it's true. He's all around us all the time. So he's there, but we just can't sense him. It's that feeling of God being a million miles away, and he might as well be as long as we're in that sin and we can't connect, right? Because one of the things that sin did is it broke our sensors. Did you notice that when you read Genesis 3, that it says that they could sense that God was moving in the garden? Because in those days, they could sense the presence of God. But our sensor got broken. And God wants to redeem that and change all of that too. You see, this whole word redeem is connected to the word atonement. In fact, the first time the word redeem is used is in the book of Exodus. It's used, that's the first time the word salvation is used too, but it's used several times in the book of Exodus. And we kind of skipped over this, but I want you to see the first time that the word redeem is used in the Bible. It's in Exodus 6:6. It says, "I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and a mighty axe of judgment." In other words, I'm going to judge anybody that gets in the way. I'm going to judge anything, including the devil, that gets in the way of this. And he says, what does this idea of redeeming mean? It literally means to buy back. I'm going to buy you back from sin. Paul talks about it when he talks about it as that we are slaves to sin. And what God is doing is buying us back from sin in Jesus. And in this the scapegoat business is exactly what God was doing. He was buying them back. He said, "You put your faith in me," and as he told Abraham, "Your faith has saved you. Or, you know, it's through your faith that I'm bringing salvation into your life." And so this redemption buys back. And fast forward to Leviticus, and in Leviticus the word redeem is used 12 times. And you can kind of see why that would be, because it's a practical thing about how to live out God's redemption in our lives. Because it says when land goes to someone else that shouldn't have it, you know, man dies and his land leaves the family, go redeem it, buy it back for that family, for that woman who's still alive and still has the kids, or the woman who is the widow, you know, go redeem her because she has no way to make a living. Bring her into your family. And there's all these laws to make sure it's fair and right. That's what the laws are for. To help us live out the redemption. Not so that we have a condition of redemption, because the redemption's already happened. The Exodus, the deliverance, happened before Mount Sinai and the law, right? So that's what it is. Or the really graphic story of redemption in the Old Testament. Remember, this is Old Testament. This isn't even New Testament, but it's exactly what we talk about in the New Testament. The really graphic story of redemption is Hosea. You read Hosea lately? 12 chapters or something like that? It is the weirdest love story you can imagine. Because God says to Hosea, who's a prophet, "I want to show my people what I want to do for them. Not just as a nation, that too, but as individual people. So I want you to go down." Imagine being Hosea and hearing this. "I want you to go down to the auction block, and I want you to buy a prostitute and bring her home and marry her." Apparently, the only one there that day was named Gomer. Because that's what he does. He brings her home, and then they name their kids all kinds of crazy stuff like, "God's not with me," you know, "God doesn't like me anymore," kind of stuff like that. It's like, what is he doing? Well, it's describing people who are living away from God and are rejecting his redemption. That's what it's describing. But here's the crazy thing about Hosea. He marries this woman, and he loves her, he loves her, he loves her, but she keeps stepping out and going back to her old life and sleeping with other guys. And every time she does, God says to Hosea, "Okay, this is a perfect illustration. I know it's tough, but I want you to go out and buy her back." So he goes out to the auction block, buys her up. This happens a few times, which is really weird. Until one day, Hosea gets the idea, "God, this isn't just about your people. I'm not just living out a living illustration, am I?" And God says, "No, you're not. This is what I'm doing for you." And suddenly you realize that what God is doing when he says he's going to redeem us is doing what we cannot do for ourselves, but all of us have in our hearts the desire, "But I wish I could." You can't, but I'll do it for you. I'll remove that sin between us. I'll remove that sin from you. And you realize that when Hosea goes and buys back and buys back and buys back, it might seem like a weird love story, but it's the most powerful love you could imagine, because that's what God does every single day over and over and over and over again in this world and in individual lives. And that's what it's talking about here when it talks about this redemption or this God going and redeeming us back, which that's why the chapter ends with this statement, God saying, "I don't want you to forget this whole thing," because it says, "This is the lasting ordinance for you, atonement." Okay, the atonement's the lasting ordinance. is to be made once a year for all the sins of the Israelites, and it was done as the Lord commanded Moses. Now, we don't need to do it once a year. We don't need because we have Jesus' ultimate atonement for us. But the point of it is that this buying back atonement is the act of buying. It's the collateral, if you will, that is used to buy us back, that God, who's only in his hands can he do this, and only have redemption when we have a scapegoat, and that is God himself. He is saying, I will be your scapegoat. And I want you to be reminded of this once a year, because this is my obsession. This is what I want to have happen. And the crazy thing is you see this play out through biblical history and throughout history, right up and through the coming of Jesus, right up and through the last 2,000 years when the prophecies are fulfilled, which gives you kind of a clue that if that happened, probably the next promise that he's coming back, that's going to happen because he's ultimately going to redeem the whole earth and the new heaven and new earth. But here's the thing. Even at this point in our history with God, that would be pretty hard to fake and have all those things show up at the right time, right? To fulfill God's redemption obsession. And I want to kind of wrap this up by showing you two passages that I don't want us to miss before we leave the Pentateuch. We'll one of them we'll be probably coming back to and reading again when we do love this book. But they both affirm parts of this redemption obsession, this whole idea of God being the redeeming God in our lives today, not just some theological idea out there, just like sin's not just some theological concept out there, but actually today doing it and changing our lives forever. And the first one's back in Exodus, at Exodus chapter 34, beginning at verse 4, where God actually defines himself. God explains clearly what kind of God he is. Look at this. It says, so Moses chiseled out two stones, stone tablets, like the first. Why did he do that? Why did he make second set of tablets? Because remember when he came down off Sinai, what he found with the first set of tablets, he found they were worshiping the golden calf, and he goes, wait. Right there in the Ten Commandments, it says, don't have any idols or images. Doggone it, and he busted them, right? So he has to make a whole new set. And so he carries these up Mount Sinai early in the morning. The Lord had commanded him, and he carried the two stone tablets in his hands. Remember, he's 80-something years old. That's a pretty heavy backpack, stone tablets. Dear God, give me that kind of strength. Okay, then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. Remember, the Lord, when you see it in caps, is the name Yahweh, which means I am that I am. But watch this. And he passed in front of Moses. Remember, this is where God puts him in the cleft of the rock, and he passes in front of him. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate, gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness and rebellion and sin. And just in case anybody's thinking, well, good, I can just sin all I want. He says, no, that's not what this means. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children for their children, and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. As we said 2 weeks ago, what that means is he's not punishing them for the sins of the parents. It's poor translation. It's meaning that he's punishing the children for the sins they commit that their parents also committed, okay? But what I want you to notice here is something very interesting. It says, the Lord, because in the Hebrew language, that means something very specific. If you see your bestie, you know, your best friend, hopefully your husband or wife, coming, and you say, Joseph, Joseph, or Mary, Mary. What you're doing in the Hebrew language is you're saying a term of endearment. You're saying, you're the best to me. You are my best friend. You are the one I love more than you. You are so dear to me. And yet, you know, there's some question about whether this applies to this definition of God defining himself, because it's usually the person who's receiving the person coming who says it. In this case, it's the person who's coming, God, who says it. But here's why I think God is saying, I am your dear Yahweh. You are my dear friend to Moses. and what he wants to say to all of us. Because he gives us, next thing is he gives us five character qualities of himself. And the first four of them are all about his redemption obsession. Look at that. Compassionate, his love for us. Gracious, God has a way of showing us grace. Slow to anger, so it's okay, you can approach the mountain. Abounding in love. And this isn't just love like compassion love or just love like warm fuzzy love. This is loyalty that never quits. This is unconditional love. This is almost tenacious, insistent, obsessive love. It's a word that's used over and over in the Old Testament. It's called hesed. But it means that kind of love. And it's all tied into this redemption obsession, which is why I think God is saying, that's how close I want to be to you. So let's get rid of this sin. I want to be your dearest. That's what I think he's saying. But then there's a fifth one, a fifth character quality, where he says, abounding in love and abounding in faithfulness. Now again, the word faithfulness actually means that God is trustworthy. You can trust him completely, totally. But it literally means that God is true. That he's truth. That he's going to reveal himself truly. Now why would he make such a big deal of that? Why would he be abounding in that? Because he knows that if Israelite society doesn't have the real picture of who he is, and if we don't have the real picture of who he is, we devolve into de-civilization, if I can coin that word. And it's why we don't see civility today in so many cultures, and why we haven't seen civility ever since the fall happened, where people start eating at each other, even though they're all made in the image of God, because they don't have the truth. And God says, I'm abounding in the truth. I am tenacious. I will keep giving you the truth about me, about yourself, about your sin, and why you need me. Now, this is very interesting to me, because in our world today, in our society, we talked about this before, there's a big movement, and a lot of people have just kind of breathed this in, and a lot of people, you know, you don't have to be a philosopher or a scholar or anything to actually believe this, but it kind of creeps in the back door, where that there is kind of a blurry line between truth and falsehood, between truth and a lie. It's sort of the yin and the yang, you know, the light and the darkness, they're all a part of the same circle, life and death, all part, don't worry about it, it's just kind of all mishmashed together, you know, truth and lies. But that's why it was so interesting to me to hear last week that there was a report, a study actually, that was released by a bunch of MIT professors that studied the very thing that you wouldn't think MIT professors would study. And it was released in the journal Science, but it made it into the New York Times twice in the last week because people are fascinated with this. And here's what the study is. They studied Twitter. And what they found is that lies spread further on Twitter and faster than the truth. It's sort of like I think it was Mark Twain said something like, I don't have the exact quote, but it was something like, you know, a lie will make it around the world twice before the truth has a chance, kind of thing. And that's true on Twitter. They said, it's true. On social media, at least on Twitter, it's true. It spreads faster and goes farther than the truth. And you know, from a Christian worldview, we would say, well, duh, yeah. Because we live in a fallen world. And in a fallen world, lies are more buzzy. You know, if you don't have a God to give you the buzz, you got to have something. So a lie is tantalizing and shocking. Ooh, right? And so it goes faster. It's the same thing that Paul said in Romans chapter 1, right up front in his magnum opus. He said, hey, you know, it's the nature of human beings to exchange the truth of God for a lie. And but that's what the MIT professors have discovered. But what's interesting is in the New York Times article, the lead researcher, Dr. Sinan Aral, here's how he concludes the article in the New York Times, an article called Some Notion of Truth. Some notion of truth is central to the proper functioning of nearly every realm of human endeavor. If we allow the world to be consumed by falsity, we are inviting catastrophe. Again, it sort of like feels like a well duh right now, but that's a scientific secular conclusion that we're headed down the wrong path. We need a redeemer. We can't fix this on our own. We can't help it. It's just like Hosea, what do I do? I can't. That's right, you can't, but I can. I can heal you. I can bring that around. Which leads right into the next passage that I don't want us to miss. And it's in Deuteronomy, and I think we'll be reading back and coming back around to it, but it's such a central passage for the Jewish faith, for the Old Testament, and in this sense, it's central for our faith because Jesus picks it up and says, this is the greatest commandment. And it has to do with what's on my ring right here. The first time I went to Israel, I got this ring, and it's called the Shema Yisrael. It means, because the word Shema means to hear, and Yisrael means Israel, okay? And even to this day, you can buy this in the stores as trinkets. It's sort of, in Judaism, especially in the offshoots and the spooky stuff like Kabbalah, you know, if you've ever heard of that, that's Madonna's religion. It's sort of like a lucky charm, you know, this verse. It's kind of what we Christians do with verses like John 3:16 sometime, or we talked about this, John 8:32, the truth, you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Yeah, but which truth is that, okay? So, you know, it's kind of like that, but I bought this because it is so central to our lives and what this whole redemption obsession. Because look what God says in this command before he says it and then after he says it. He says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." In other words, we're not polytheists. We don't worship a whole bunch of gods. We worship one God. "Love the Lord your God. Love Yahweh your God. With all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength." And then what will happen? "These commandments that I give you today are to be in your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them to the symbols to your hands." Got it on my ring. "Bind them to your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." That pretty well covers anything if somebody could do in those days, right? All of their life. And I'm not saying that this is a lucky charm by saying, okay, I got it on my hand. I don't think we need to do that today. But that's why you see, you know, the phylacteries of the Jewish rabbi dudes. And, you know, they've got stuff carrying little boxes on their hands and stuff, the particularly conservative ones. But, and again, I don't want to, I've done this a couple of times in this series, I don't want to be sacrilegious or unspiritual. I don't want to call the curses of Revelation down on my head because it says if you change this book, all these curses are on you. But let me just sort of bring this command, this promise into the vernacular, okay? If we could just kind of bring it really up to date. This is the DSV. The Duane Insidious version. Here it is. "Listen, instead of spending all your time on Twitter getting your news from and opinions from Facebook and Google, or believing the lie that you can actually have a relationship on social media, love me. Focus on me 24/7 and do it with such passion that I rub off on you. And your life changes forever." In other words, I'm the one doing this. I'll do this for you. And oh, by the way, teach your children to do the same. A little discipleship there at the end. I think that's what he's trying to say to us. You know, that there is a truth, that there is this God. And we look at the world, we look at life, we go, oh, I can't. God says, yeah, I can. But I can. That's okay. Yeah, you can't. It's part of this redemption obsession. It was interesting to me to see Stephen Hawking, you know, the things that were said about him this week after he died. And good thing. It's good to pause because he was an amazing scientist. It's like if you were alive when Einstein died, it would be the same thing, or Isaac Newton. That's how big a brain this guy was. All from a wheelchair, living 50 years with ALS, you know? I mean, it's phenomenal. But he had a lot of chances to join God in this redemptive obsession of God's. And he didn't. The longer it went, the more he was clear, there is no God. Your brain, he clearly said this. He says, my brain is just a computer, and when it breaks, it's like any other computer. It just stops. It's nothing to worry about. It's just, that's the way it is. My body's a biomachine. Brilliant man. But it's such a tragedy. Because Again, if that's all it is, what about that voice that's inside of us that says, there's got to be more than that? And that voice inside of us is a remnant from Eden when we were knew that we were made in the image of God and our sensors worked and we could tell that God was for real and he wanted the best for us and he showed his love for us and he shows his love for us every day. Right? That's what that is. And so God says, I have obsessed, passionately obsessed for you. And I'm going to break that curse. You watch me. I am going to break that curse. You know, if you've been here very long, you know that I screw up Christmas and Easter from up here at least once a year. I say Easter at Christmas or Christmas at Easter. And I know that it's Easter that's 2 weeks from now, just so you know. But as I was studying up on this, a song, a Christmas song, came to my mind that we all know. We don't always sing the verse for it. In fact, the verse I want to show you, I had a hard time finding it on Twitter. I had to go to Twitter, yeah, that's all lies on Twitter. But anyway, I couldn't find it until I went to three or four lyric sites because they leave it out. Like if you listen to the popular Christmas music like Pentatonix and those kind of guys, which is not a problem, I do too, but they leave this verse out. Lo and behold. But when Isaac Watts wrote it hundreds of years ago, back then they just packed their Christian songs with theology because that was the way they taught people, right? And aren't you glad I'm speaking to you and not singing it today? Okay, but that's what they did. But here's the third verse of a song you know, Joy to the World. Look at this. No more let sins and sorrows grow. There it is. Oh, because that's what it causes. And thorns infest the ground. The earth is messed with this too. He comes to make his blessings flow. Far as the curse is found. That's what it is. That's the whole point. That's the point of Leviticus 16. That's the point of the character of God entering into this world, that you can't, I can't, but he can. But it's not where he leaves it. If you noticed in Deuteronomy 6, he tells us, I want you to join me in this world in spreading this good news. I want you to join me because I want you to pass it on to your kids. I want you to pass it on to families. I want you to be public about it. I want you to spread the word that that's who I am and that's what I'm doing. And so a little later in Leviticus, he tells us how we can be most like him in spreading this redemption business and how we can be most like him in getting back and showing that we're on our way back to Eden, because back then people treated each other like they were made in the image of God. And it's in Leviticus, of all places, that this statement shows up. Look at this. Leviticus 19, 18. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people. But, and then he drops the bomb. Because the first part is like, well, yeah, we shouldn't do grudges. We shouldn't do that. That's, of course not. We shouldn't bear the grudge or get revenge. I mean, yeah, it makes sense. Okay, good. Civilized people don't do that. And then he says, love your neighbor as yourself. What? How do I do that? I can't do that. Which is why at the end he says, I am the Lord. Yeah, of course you can't, but I can. I can do it through you. I can transform you to the point that you became a society transformer, a family transformer. And I don't mean those machines. I mean, you can become one because I am the Lord who genuinely loves your neighbor as yourself, and it all changes. I was reminded of this last night. I didn't say this first service, so this is a freebie because you got a little extra. There's this new show on TV that I'm not recommending yet because I've only seen 3 episodes. It's a sitcom. Never used to watch sitcoms. But this one's called Living Biblically, about a guy who's trying to live the Bible. And he's back in the Old Testament trying to live out these laws, which is pretty funny. Because we know that was fulfilled in Jesus, okay, in case that's why it's funny. But last night's show, or the one I watched last night, was all about loving your neighbor as yourself. And just trying to operate that way in this world. But there were some pretty good insights about, you know, If I hug this coworker, am I getting in trouble? And how do I love a person in a world that has all its dynamics and sin is infested today? It's fascinating. But God says, you don't have to take that. This is the difference in the show. He's trying to do it on his own. God said, don't do this on your own. I am the Lord. I will do this through you. And by the time you fast forward to the New Testament, you get, the Apostle Paul in his magnum opus, the book of Romans, that explains the theology. The first 13 chapters of the book of Romans is primarily all about God's redemption obsession and how to join him in with it. And right at the end, in chapter 13, he says, and love your neighbor as yourself. And if you do that, all the other commands, all the other stuff is going to take care of itself, including loving God. Because remember, sin broke not just our God relationship, it broke our relationship with each other. So if you get that and you let God live that through, he'll weave together that relationship too. You'll sense him in your life. But in chapter 10 of the book of Romans, Paul says, this is the best way to love your neighbor as yourself. He gives a sort of a clear picture of what really makes the difference. These are the verses. These are the last verses we're going to read. He says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So there you have the redemption obsession right there. And that's Joel, the book of Joel 2, verse 32, by the way. How then can they call on the one they have not believed in? And how can they believe in the one in whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? He's talking sharing with them. It's kind of a weird, it's not what I'm doing right now is the only way for somebody to hear. It's all of us sharing with someone. And how can anyone preach or share unless they are sent? As it is written, God has already sent us. How beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news, from the book of Psalms. I'm going to call the band out here, and I'm going to ask you to do something. If you haven't been taking notes, that's cool. Just take out a pencil or something out of the seat back or somewhere, because I want you to write these two things down. That how this week we will love our neighbors as ourselves. The next 2 weeks, really. Because before I do that, I'm going to just remind you, there's a gift. Just like the law is a gift, it's not a contingency on whether or not, you know, if you keep this, then you can be my child, my person. God's not saying that. He's saying, you're already my person. You've already been redeemed. So here's a confirmation. Here's the tools on how to live it out. God has given us a gift that is so powerful. It's the most effective thing. It's the most affective thing that you and I can do. But we take it for granted so often. It's remarkable, really, when you think about it. And what I'm talking about is prayer. So I'm going to ask you to pray this week, the next 2 weeks, for two things. One's a national thing, and one, though, is something you already know about that's a local thing leading into Easter. The national thing is that, I don't know if you knew this, but California has a law that says this. Pregnancy resource centers, you know, those alternatives to the abortion clinics that Christians run mostly. Other religions do some of it too, but mostly it's Christian. And it's targeted at them. They can't tell these women that come to them what their options are besides abortion until they've offered them and shown them, we're the pregnancy resource center. If you want an abortion, the clinic, the Planned Parenthood clinic is over there. And then they have to wait to see what the woman says before they do the ultrasound, before they do any of that, which obviously shoots the whole process in the foot, because she has to not only walk in the door, but she has to go and make that decision again. This, by the way, was introduced in the last few years in Oregon's legislature twice, but it's been knocked down. But if this thing passes the Supreme Court on Tuesday, we're going to have problems. Actually, they're not going to make the decision on Tuesday, but the arguments for and against for this California law will be on the Supreme Court on Tuesday. So pray for the men in black, okay? Pray for the attorneys, pray for the Supreme Court. But the other thing is much more personal, up close and at home right now, and that's your Frank list. And I know that you've already taken those up. If you haven't done it, you can still do it. And if you have done it, I'm just asking you to pray. I know Frank is a weird name, weird thing to call him. Okay, it's not a guy's name. If it helps you, just go with the French, Frank. Okay. But all of those, here's why it works for me. All of those letters represent a people, friends, relatives, acquaintances, neighbors, coworkers, and if you've got somebody who doesn't fit one of those letters, you can put your own letter in there. Okay? So but they represent people. It's all a part of being a part of those people that Paul just said. How blessed are the feet of those who bring good news. That there is a God who will redeem us. That there is a God who will be our scapegoat. And everybody deserves a chance to hear that news. So you pray that they'll come on Easter and that you might be able to invite them. If they live in another city, you pray that they're going to go on Easter to a gospel preaching church on that day, because that's exactly what we're going to do. Pray that God will bring the people in their lives that will give them that message. And he says, you can't, but I can. Let me pray for us. Heavenly Father, I thank you for not just leaving us here, not leaving us to struggle in this thing that's between us, but that you have shown us the way, that you've made a way, that you have single-handedly defeated the war that sin has caused between us, between each other, and worst of all, between you and us as people. I thank you for your presence here today. I thank you that even in things that we don't fully understand, like books like Leviticus, you have powerful, powerful things to say. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for coming. Prepare our hearts to celebrate it and to worship you like never before on Easter. That you have died for us to redeem us. That you've been our scapegoat. And then you've risen from the dead to beat back the power of that sin once and for all, and the power of death in our lives once and for all. Thank you. Thank you for answering the cries of our hearts. We love you, Jesus. That's why we pray in your name. Amen.